Thank you for tuning in to the Best of Movie Geeks United, a collection of some of our most memorable conversations from our archives. Tonight, we welcome three terrific character actors, starting with Toby Jones, whose portrayed real-life character is as varied as Karl Rove, Truman Capote, and Alfred Hitchcock, followed by RoboCop himself, Peter Weller, and finally, from Frasier fame, David Hyde Pierce.
The movie geeks are honored to bring to the program one of our most profoundly talented actors. Toby Jones has worked on stage and screen for quite some time. In fact, in 2001, he starred in the London West End comedy Kenneth Branagh directed, the play What I Wrote, which earned him the Olivier Award for Best Actor in a Supporting Role, as well as a Tony Award nomination when it transferred here to Broadway. Earlier films include The Messenger, Finding Neverland, Miss Henderson Presents, Elizabeth I, and of course his voice work as Dobby in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Mm-hmm. But it was his searing portrayal of Truman Capote in 2006's brilliant film, Infamous, which set his career in high gear, resulting in a continued string of unforgettable performances in films like The Painted Veil and The Mist. This year he graces the screen with three more incredible works: in City of Ember, as Karl Rove in Oliver Stone's George Bush film W, and as legendary Hollywood maverick Swifty Lazar in Ron Howard's Frost Nixon. I had the great delight of speaking with Mr. Jones early this morning as he called in from his home in London, and it was a bit early for me. So if my voice sounds a little softer than usual, that's why. And also, I must say, it sounds sexier than usual, too, when I wake up first thing in the morning. So you'll notice my come-hither voice. It's very appealing.
There you go. That's all we needed to know.
Yeah, this is a tremendous conversation with a terrifically generous and talented actor. Here's our conversation with Mr. Toby Jones.
I have to tell you that whenever someone asks me for my favorite actors, you're always on the top of the list. So I
especially to me. I bet you say that to all your pod guests.
That's not true at all. No. I'm very taken by your work, so I appreciate you being on.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Now, I'm looking at your release schedule. It's City of Ember, October 10th.
Yeah.
W, October 17th. Frost Nixon in December. You're really owning the multiplexes this season.
I don't know about the multiplex. Do you think all of those will be multiplex films?
I think that a couple of those definitely have that potential. They're all such high quality films with great filmmakers behind them.
I mean, that is the real, for me, that's the most extraordinary thing, is the thrill of working with those three directors in their different ways is so remarkable. And as a British actor, to go over to the States, certainly in the case of Frost Nixon and W, and work with people whose films you've grown up watching, it's a fantastic thing.
Well, something strikes me about you, and maybe I'm off base, but these are such wonderfully challenging, risky roles that you've taken on. You have your whole career. But I think the thing that impresses me most about you are those choices, but it seems to me that you gravitate towards the material that frightens you the most. And I'm wondering how fear benefits you as an actor, if that is the case.
On a very practical level, fear keeps you awake at night, so you get more time to work on roles. Because you can't leave, if you're working on a voice, or if you're working just to research, right, so you know what on earth you're talking about. But joking aside, when you're an actor, if you're not playing lead roles all the time, mm-hmm, then it's quite chaotic, your life. You're thinking, what's on the table? What am I going up for? What may I get? What might I not get? And it's quite chaotic. I would say that, given the choice between two parts, if two parts came up simultaneously, I would certainly pick the other one because as an actor, you're trying to stay a moving target. You're not really trying to confirm what people already know about you.
Yes,
I've never really understood people who want to do just one thing. But of course, it's a hard thing to do because people begin to associate you with certain parts. I just had the call before I spoke to you, I just had a call about a part, an American part, to do on radio here, which I love. Mm-hmm. And they said, we can't think of anyone else. We can't think of anyone else who could do it but you, and please do it, and, which is incredibly flattering. And I suppose that is the aim, I suppose, is to try and play a wide variety of parts as possible.
Well, and the roles you have chosen, some of these roles are so iconic, and so I would think doing them as well as you do, it would be easy to be pigeonholed as one or the other if you weren't so versatile in your choices. But I'm thinking, of course, of Capote in Infamous, which
yeah.
I think is an extraordinary performance and the most extraordinary film that year. And,
you loved the film?
I adored the film.
Yeah, I have to say to you, Jeremy, that I think, you know, everyone always tries to sympathize with me, but, you know, it's very, very rare that a script that good will come your way, and the fact you get to act in it outweighs any kind of people feel a need to commiserate. But that's only because people didn't see it on the opening weekend. That gradually a film permeates the culture in a way that didn't used to happen.
Right.
And I think that that film has found a very wide, enthusiastic audience. I know it has, and I'm very pleased with that, because I just thought when I first read that script, it was so good that I'd never have a chance to play that part.
I think this story is bigger than an article. I think it's a book.
I can see that. But nonfiction, right?
Yes, of course it will all be true, but...
But what? Either it is or it isn't.
You're not understanding. I want to bring fictional techniques to a nonfiction story.
What fictional techniques? The ones where you make stuff up?
Excuse me, if I were going to make stuff up, do you think I'd bother taking all these notes?
Well, you're obviously planning to turn Bonnie Clutter into some faux poetic recluse when what it sounds like is that she was just thrown off by her menopause.
What is your stupid point?
That you shouldn't be doing what you're doing. The truth is enough.
I must say, I don't appreciate this lecture from you, of all people. Mockingbird was based on true things, and you sure improved that.
Right. It's a novel. Reportage means recreating, not creating.
This is a new kind of reportage.
Oh, and the way you play it and the way it is written, the part has so many colors to it.
And
the film is lively and deeply sad, and it's an amazing experience. But also, you know, Karl Rove and the upcoming W and Swifty Lazar and Frost Nixon and these real-life kind of iconic characters. I'm wondering...
Yeah.
What your process is in crafting these, are they essentially the same when you're tackling a role such as these?
I suppose the process has emerged just because of those recently playing people who are actually either alive or certainly died relatively recently. I suppose, you know, you try and watch as much footage of them as you can, and in the case of Capote there was a lot of footage, interview footage, and in the case of Karl Rove you have the extraordinary thing of finishing a day's filming, going home and watching him live on TV, which is slightly strange. And then with Swifty Lazar, it's slightly different because it's very, very hard to get any footage of him, working with his voice, I got access to some CDs of his voice dictating stuff, which is really useful. So it varies, but how one does it, I think there's a certain amount of research that goes in of reading what people would imagine goes into researching a part, and then there's a kind of intuitive thing that has to take over because you just don't know how people pick up the phone or redial numbers or sit alone in their hotel bedroom or finish their meal or get up. There's just no way of doing that. And I think that's when
that you know, using one's imagination, you try and piece together something. And on good screenplays, which all the ones I've mentioned are, they suggest a dynamic that you're sort of trying to either work with or work against to suggest character in it.
Yeah, there's many examples of this, but the one that comes to mind is, I remember hearing an interview with De Niro years back when he was preparing Cape Fear, and he said that he started to find the character when he started to try on those really garish Hawaiian shirts. I was wondering, have you built any of these characters from the outside in?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, in general terms, I suppose I have, because that was the way I was trained, which is I was trained a lot in movement, and so I suppose I'm drawn to try and find the way people move, but moving in the widest sense, because, of course, their voice is movement as well, and has to be to try and link the voice to the body so that you're not just doing a voice and then doing everything else, but trying to find out how the voice comes out of the body is the challenge, really, because otherwise I think it looks like you're trying to imitate someone, which you're not really. You're trying to actually create a character very heavily based on the person you're playing, you know.
Yeah. Is there kind of an aha moment for you when there's a adjustment or a phrase or something that you find where you know, I've got it, this character?
Well, I mean, it depends slightly on the size of the part. Obviously, Truman Capote is by far the biggest role I've ever played on screen, and there are many aha moments when you're trying to work out why he might speak in that extraordinary way, and that's partly anatomical reasons, and also you're sort of thinking about the way he grew up and where he grew up. So that's a sort of longer process. But when you haven't got so much time, to a certain extent with Karl Rove and Swifty Lazar, there's a photo of Swifty Lazar. There's a story of Swifty Lazar as a young man, and he looks extraordinary. I mean, as an older man, he looks sort of he's an extraordinary concoction of high fashion and wealth.
Yeah. Yeah.
On this tiny man with these very famous spectacles.
Right.
But then you think he's going to be eccentric and wildly amusing and stuff. And I'm not sure that he is. I think what he is incredibly tough guy who fights to be taken seriously. And he started out his career as a music agent going from club to club. And there's actually a great story about him glassing Otto Preminger when there was some problem over the rights to In Cold Blood. And Swifty Lazar literally getting up from his table, he's a tiny man, smaller than Truman Capote, and clacking this enormous Otto Preminger with a glass. And that fighter thing, that sort of felt very important, because that's a useful thing to play against the kind of exotic, eccentric dress that the guy doesn't get the joke, you know. And Karl Rove, I just always think Karl Rove, you know, I was struck, the first thing I ever thought about before I was even asked to play Karl Rove, is it always looks like he's listening to a joke, you know, always somewhere that no matter what is thrown at him, no matter how much, you know, shit gets thrown at him, he always appears to be, I was saying somewhere that it's like he's getting circus music piped in directly into his ear or something. Is it just a kind of, it's all a big game, and a game that he plays incredibly well, or has done up to now, and I'm not sure how ideological Karl Rove actually is deep down, fundamentally. I think he's fascinated by the whole game of it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Rove, in that I hear actors speak about, even if they're playing the most villainous of parts, because even if you're playing the villain, you're the hero of your own story.
Yeah.
That you must have some level of sympathy or empathy for your characters, and I'm wondering where you found that in Rove.
Well, I think, you know, I think you're right the way you put it. The thing is, everyone's trying to do the best they can in life, and some people forget that the strategies that they're using to be the best that they can at whatever it is they're doing have. You know, they don't coincide with what other people are doing. and also that what they've done that may not work anymore for a different situation.
Right.
And I think that Karl Rove had a very strange childhood. He lost his, his parents divorced, and he became very close to his stepfather, who then moved away. And I don't mean his stepfather, I mean the second father. So there's turbulence there, there's a lot of turbulence there. And from what you hear about it, he's sort of monstrously controlling of his staff. And this need to control, this need to be in charge, this need to be at the center of the universe. These are things that are neither good nor bad. They're just ways people are coping with the world. And they're in a way much more interesting and useful for an actor than any judgment about whether people are, how good or bad society views them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really not my job as an actor to do that. It's the job of the writer, first of all, to put you in situations.
Sure.
And then oftentimes the most interesting thing would be to play against that, to play against the badness of the situation or play against the goodness of the situation.
Well, I'm a huge fan, as we all are, with the work of Oliver Stone, and with this film and so many of his other films, I think this is where he thrives. It feels like this movie is in kind of a dangerous area. It's right there on the edge, and I'm wondering.
Yeah, he seems to absolutely love that. Yeah,
I'm wondering if you felt that as an actor.
Yeah, I felt that he was. He's a very inspirational director. He's his energy and his refusal to take the easy option, even when budgetary demands are put upon him, is very inspiring. It's the kind of thing you want to be around, that kind of energy. And his, people have talked about it, but maybe it's not so widely known about just how much information he has in his head about history, both recent political history and ancient political history. He has sort of direct access to this. And so when he's strutting around a film set and coming in whispering in your ear and directing things, he has that film director's skill of being able to listen to many different voices in his head simultaneously. But one of those voices is this political historical knowledge, and he's able to cite things, almost at will, instances of things. That's amazing. I mean, it's really astonishing.
Is it possible, because I know you do your fair share of stage work as well, is it possible to have that kind of sense of freedom on a film set that you do on a theater stage?
Well, it's never, you're never going to have control of time in a way that you do on stage. The thrill for the actor on stage is that you're in charge of controlling the time. And obviously, the director and the editor and to some extent film executives are the eventual deciders of time. But if you have a director like Oliver Stone, I suppose, or indeed Doug McGrath on Infamous, who wants to tell a story they want to use extravagant, flamboyant characters to tell a story that may look realist but requires great dynamics in the performance, you're going to get freedom of performance, And in fact, both those directors pushed me to go further in my characterization than my instincts for acting on film, first suggested.
I mean, I know that the approach of this film is satirical in a way.
Have you seen it?
Not as of yet, no, sir.
No. I haven't seen the film yet. But what's interesting about the whole satirical thing is I think that people may be expecting a ha-ha ride. And there's two things I would imagine I'm going to see when I see this film. And the first one is that I don't think people are going to come out and go, God, George Bush, what an idiot. I think they will think certainly big aspects of what decisions he's made will be based on limited understanding of problems or an understanding that is conditioned by more personal things, a bit like we've been talking about the other characters. I think that much of the film is about his struggle to escape the shadow of his past. And that's a very serious theme, and I think it's treated seriously. Nonetheless, he's for all his extraordinary memory, George W. Bush, he's not a great analyst. He says in the film he's a gut player, and I think that it would be weird not to laugh at some of the... laugh very darkly, because we're all suffering the consequences of his limited understanding. But what's interesting is, which I like in any film, is the complicated tone of it, really.
And I think that Stone embraces that. His Nixon painted a brilliant man with just tremendous demons, and I thought it was very, very sympathetic.
Me too.
I think that's a big strength of Oliver Stone's that people refuse to point out. Tell me, the one film that we haven't discussed is City of Ember, and that opens up on October 10th. Tell me a little bit about that one.
Well, that one, I went to meet the director for that, Gil Keenan, who's clearly a genius. It didn't take very long to realize he was a genius, because he lifted up and showed me some pictures and stuff like that, and I'd read the script, and it's not the most demanding part I've ever played. It allows me to act with Bill Murray, which is great thrill. But what's very exciting about it, I think, is the world that Gil has created in the film, which is a sort of Gilliam-esque world.
Mm-hmm.
It's a world for fans of people like Terry Gilliam, who make microcosms, who make fantasy films that aren't not a whole new set of rules so much as a kind of comment on the rules we're already almost living by.
Mm.
And it's just visually very, very beautiful and very, very daring for a studio to make a film like this for children, because it's very dark for children, which is one of the great things about the book. But also it's just, it's a very interesting cast, in it, very diverse cast in it. And again, it's a dark theme for kids, it's an adventure of someone underground, trying to escape back into the real world, which they've been told is destroyed.
It looks fascinating. I was fascinated.
Yeah.
I knew that I just had to see what that film was when I saw that trailer. You come from a family of performers. It's kind of acting seems to be in your blood in a way. I know your father.
Yeah.
He's in one of my favorite films, which is Wild at Heart.
Yes.
Did you catch that early from them?
It's hard to get immunization from those things. My dad's a pretty private man, a pretty shy man, and when he works, he works. When he comes home, he comes home. He doesn't live by a swimming pool in L.A. waiting for the phone to ring. He lives a very quiet life, and like a lot of actors. So I don't think I got seduced by any glamour of it. I think I was very aware of the excitement of certain jobs taking you across the world to meet extraordinary people. I mean, that's the great privilege of our job, is that we get to work with people who have fought very hard to be where they are in the industry, and who are kind of incredibly intelligent, fascinating people. Whether they're makeup artists, special effects people, editors, or cameramen, or even, grips and people like that, who have worked in a lot of very strange places doing strange things. And I think that both he and I share a love of meeting those people. And I think that sense of adventure I got quite early, definitely.
Well, these three films this season look fantastic, and I'm
Thank
sure
you.
You're going to. I appreciate your talent and your generosity so much. Thank you.
Thanks,
so
Jamie.
Much,
good luck.
Let's mention some of our next guest's credits. What a great career he's had,
mm-hmm.
And a terrific actor that he is.
Yeah.
The New Age, Naked Lunch, RoboCop. I mean, that's the biggie. You can't get much bigger than that.
And he was on 24 recently.
24. A fantastic actor, Mighty Aphrodite. He's worked with some of the great
mm-hmm.
filmmakers. He's a great, strong, charismatic presence on screen, one of our great actors.
Mm-hmm.
And we were thrilled to welcome him onto the show.
The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai is the big cult film on his resume, as it is on many actors' resumes, such as John Lithgow and Jeff Goldblum.
Did you say more, even more cultish than Naked Lunch?
You know, it's a very...
Because that's another big cult film, too, but I was just curious.
The Buckaroo Banzai, I think the tone of Buckaroo Banzai, the playful tone, kind of lends itself more to a larger cult status.
All right, I think I'll go with that.
I could be mistaken.
No, because, I mean, it's a movie, as our audience will find out. I don't even think people would know what to do with it today, and executives. I don't think anyone will ever know what to do with it.
Well, we'll talk more about it on the other end of this.
Yeah.
This is an actor we both admire greatly, Mr. Peter Weller, revisiting his Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai experience.
Evil! Pure and simple from the eighth dimension!
I'm not ready for this.
So what? Big deal.
Great Buckaroo Banzai, a common grave danger confronts both our worlds.
These are Martian names: John Webb, John Fat Eating, John Icicle Boy.
Martian.
In New Jersey.
Buckaroo, President of Line 1 calling about, is everything okay with the alien space club and Planet 10, or should he just go ahead and destroy Russia?
Tell him yes on 1 and no on 2.
Which was yes, destroy Russia or number 2?
Forget about me. Don't never break me.
Penny, get off the phone.
We're giving you a chance to save your planet.
I want
emergency
services now!
So let's talk a little bit about Buckaroo Banzai. It's a tremendous cult classic now, but when you were first offered the script, as I understand it, you were a little hesitant about doing it.
Well, I was only hesitant about doing it because there was another movie in the works, and I thought maybe I wanted to be the romantic lead, at least in a movie that I understood.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. But the thing is that
the romantic lead looked to be going to somebody else between me and another guy in the other film. And the more I read Buckaroo, the more, you know, I realized it was going to be remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Unique, yeah.
And what could you take in your discussions with the director? What was your understanding of what the tone of the film would be?
I didn't know what the tone of the film would be. You know, I know what the genre was. I mean, the head of marketing at 20th Century, after the film was wrapped, asked me, what is this film? So I didn't know what the genre. I knew it was funny. I knew there were funny guys in it. I knew it was an action movie. You know, I knew it was also sort of a spiritual film.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I knew it was metaphysical. It was sci-fi. I didn't know what the hell it was.
Right.
And truly upon wrapping it, this wonderful woman, whose name I forget, God bless her, you know, said, "What do you think this film is?" I said, "I don't know." Finally, an editor friend of mine, a guy named Dean Goodhill, later got an Oscar nomination for Fugitive, said, "I'll tell you what that film is. It's a comedy, pure and simple."
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is.
Yeah, it didn't take itself seriously. It had fun with itself, very tongue in cheek. That's what we loved about it. We got all the jokes and everything. It was like someone took, there was a movie a couple years before that came out called Megaforce, which took itself so seriously, and this was almost like a parody of that. But I mean,
yeah, but you know what? I don't think it was a parody though. I have to really say that's the one thing I want to stay away from. It's not a satire, and it's not a parody. I mean, if you've ever met Earl Mac Roush, you would know that he wasn't writing a parody of sci-fi or action. He was truly writing a sort of a metaphysical comedy. There's no film like Buckaroo. I have to tell you this because not only because I'm in it, or John Lithgow's in it, or Christopher Lloyd, or you know all of the other, or Goldblum, all of whom are still remain very dear friends, Ellen Barkin. But you know, we all know that it's not a satire. It's not a goof.
It's not a parody.
It's not. So it's not really built on any. You know, it's got several genres in it, but it's not really based on anything. And it's dense enough whereby, to this day, when I run into John Lithgow, we go, "What was that movie about?"
What fascinates me about how you built this character. You read about certain actors that prepare characters based on other individuals. Kind of, they make an amalgam of these different personalities. And you, where did you go for inspiration for Buckaroo Banzai?
I went to Jacques Cousteau and Adam Ant. those are the two people on whom I based this. I'd seen interviews with Jacques Cousteau, and I thought, my God, how does that guy get so many things done?
Right.
And I just always not overwhelmed at his fantastic. Look, your guy's a fantastic mariner. He's a marine biologist. He invented the scuba.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jacques Cousteau invented scuba.
Yes.
Did you know that?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that. And not only that, he was a scientist and a photographer. He had to be all those things to be on his boat, and that's what he was. And you know, he'd be on TV and he'd be talking about all these things he'd accomplished in a year, and thought, you know, that sort of razzmatazz bag of talent that Jacques Cousteau was. And then I was a big Adam Ant fan, and Adam Ant sort of, he was he's an iconoclast, he was sort of anti-image, but he had his own image, and he was, you know, a throwback, sort of retro, but sort of modern, and I still like Adam Ant to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So there was something about Adam Ant. There was something about Adam Ant that was unique in his whole wonderful presentation and singing, and you know, I got to play the trumpet, a little bit of guitar, and sing, and
you are a musician, and if I understand correctly, you still play with Mr. Goldblum as well occasionally, right?
You know, I do play. I still play in a sextet. And when Mr. Goldblum's in town, he's not in town, like, you know, we do play together. Right now I'm playing in a sextet without him, but I'll play with him again when he comes back, for sure, because I love playing with Jeff. And we started off playing together. And Woody Allen and Miles Davis are the two people who personally inspired us to put a band together.
Wow.
Oh, goodness.
That's incredible.
And you worked with Woody Allen.
I did work with Woody Allen. And
yeah,
Woody Allen's one of his dearest friends is his set photographer, a guy named Brian Hamill, who's also extraordinarily famous for posters. He did the great poster of the last quarter century of Robert De Niro on Raging Bull.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's won all sorts of awards for his posters and The Natural with Redford and on and on and on and stuff. But he's done all the great Woody posters and set photography of Manhattan. And Woody and I had met through Brian because he's one of my dearest friends. And Brian's also the brother of Pete Hamill and John Hamill and Dennis Hamill, great writing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'd met Woody a while before I worked with him. So although honored to work with Woody, you know, it was not like a new deal. Like, I felt like I'd known Woody a long time. Also, we have jazz in common, and Woody's fairly prolific in his knowledge about jazz.
Mm-hmm. When you're actually shooting the film, what was the biggest challenge for you?
The biggest challenge for me was not to bust out laughing in every scene I had, because I was surrounded by extraordinarily funny people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ellen Barkin is hysterical, and Pepe Serna and Goldblum and Clancy Brown and there's a scene where Lloyd and Lithgow are tying me to that torture chamber.
Yeah.
I laughed. I think I blew 50 takes. I was laughing so hard.
See, I was just thinking, how could you keep a straight face with all those people around?
I couldn't keep a straight face. I mean, those guys are hysterical. Lloyd, my oldest friend, Lloyd and I and Lithgow know each other back from the theater days in New York, back in the early 70s. And I did a couple of plays with Lloyd. I never got the honor to act with Lithgow on stage, but that's how far we go back. So, you know, Lloyd shows up, big brute, big brute. And, you know, and there's Lithgow with this outrageous Italian, Emiliano Lizardo. And, you know, they're going to, you know, and they're doing this banter. Can you know, the whole scene is between them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Monkey Boy. I was laughing my way through the whole film. The music was a challenge. I'd never sung in a film. It was a pleasure to do that. That was a big challenge. But the whole film was a hoot. I have to say that there was nothing, you know, like Naked Lunch was very difficult. There were the parts of RoboCop that were just extraordinarily grueling and
mm-hmm.
athletic. But Buckaroo mm-hmm. was like a dream come true.
Yeah.
It was just wonderful.
Well, I know that there are big expectations around the film, and it didn't perform as well as was hoped, but years later it gained a cult following, as we've mentioned. What didn't people get about it upon its release that they got years later?
Look, I had to put everything on the shoulders of marketing, but, you know, they always say that a film doesn't open because it's not marketed right. A film, any film can open, but, you know, that's whether it hangs on, it's got legs. But they didn't know what that film was.
Right.
You know, maybe today we still don't know. Maybe in retrospect we know it's a comedy, like my friend Dean Goodhill said. But they didn't know how to market it. You know, they didn't know what the thing was. They, you know, there's funny scenes. If you get the DVD, you know, with all the cut scenes when all those guys are driving, they offer them some battery, and you know, Lloyd says, "No, thank you, I'm driving." You know, there's stuff in it. You know, that they cut out of it that I think they should have left in it. And geared the whole deal to a comedy. But I just have to say that I don't think it performed well because, and it was no fault of anyone, because I don't think that they knew what they had.
Right.
And they didn't know how to, you know, drive it with one marketing deal. You know, you got a horror film, for instance, you got a comedy, you know, you got an action film, yeah, throw that into the trailers and, I don't know. That's my take. That's my two cents on it.
When it was released on home video that following year, we had rented it because my mom and I saw it when it came out in the theaters, and we loved it, and we brought it home for everyone to watch. And I noticed the film, like in high school and with everything around the area, gained that, you know, people started to watch it and really enjoyed it. They really got into it. And that was in 85.
Yeah. And well, people, you know, have come up to me all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And know things about the film, and not just the, you know, the techies that are like all into the film because they're like into films and into like, you know, offbeat or zen-like comedies, but just people who dig the film for what it is, you know, that it's like it's an original statement of the possibilities of the compassion of mankind, you know, to save himself. That's what it really is, and I think that's what the message is there. And people love the message, and look, you know, at the end of it. You know, a Rastafarian, a black Rastafarian alien says, "So what? Big deal." Show me another film that's got that in it.
You got me there.
Even so, there's been for years and years talk of a sequel. What have you ever heard anything come of that?
Oh, they talk about a sequel all the time. They talk about a television series. They talk about this and that. And sadly, The major producer, David Beagle, and bless his heart, killed himself. And
mm-hmm.
then the guy who owned the studio, Bruce McNall, you know, went away for a while to, you know, the federal farm. And but now he's back and doing well, and I stay in touch with him. And, you know, I don't know what the confusion is about ever getting a sequel together, but or what the tie-up of it was, but 20th Century didn't seem to be behind the thing, and they're still talking about a series.
Right, right. It's still got major currency and a very loyal fan base, the whole Buckaroo Banzai universe.
Buckaroo Banzai universe. Yes, perfect Tommy.
Mr. Weller, we love your work. And actually, Jerry and I were just talking the other day, and we were going on and on about Naked Lunch and the New Age.
Yeah, you did such great work with Judy Davis. Will you work with her again? Because you have great chemistry on screen together.
You know what Judy Davis said to me that as we were wrapping the New Age, a film I really am honored to have been part of.
I love that film. That's a great film.
You know, to this day, in spite of the fact that I'm in it, it's still the most frightening film about Los Angeles. I don't know if you guys live in Los Angeles, but...
For a little bit, I did.
Well, you know, it's a frightening place. You know?
Yeah, oh, it is.
It's like air, you know?
Yeah.
There's nothing really of concrete to sort of grab onto.
Yeah, but I...
And that film is, you know, what the, as I say in Latin, the nec plus ultra of films about Los Angeles, about what's frightening about Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
But Judy Davis said on the day we wrapped that film, after doing Naked Lunch and then The New Age, she turned to me and she said, you know, we've become the Astaire and Rogers of the dysfunctional relationship.
That's a great relationship. That's great.
She's brilliant, though. I just have to think about her, though. She's possibly, like, I've worked with Diane Wiest and Diane Keaton and her. And I worked with a host of people, but I'd say the three standout people I worked with, like Suzanne said, you know, a good actress is infinitely more interesting than even a great actor, you know, because they have a certain sense of abandon that actors don't have. He said that, unless you're Marlon Brando, who's the most abandoned of all.
Right.
But I have to say, so the greatest people I've worked with are women. And of those three women, you know, I have to say that Judy Davis is maybe something. You just, when you were acting with Judy Davis, you know, it's like what Fred Astaire said about Sid Charisse. When you dance with Sid Charisse, you stay danced. Well, you know, you act with Judy, you just throw your car in neutral and let her invent, because there's nothing that I could ever come up with that could compete with the music, you know, in her. So
she is
right.
Phenomenal. And we were talking about Woody Allen earlier, and just incredible performances she's given in Woody Allen's films.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Oh, incredible.
I don't think there's a Judy Davis performance I've ever seen that doesn't just blow me away.
Yeah.
You know, she just is got stuff in her that, you know, that's, you know, endless.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mr. Weller, please come back and talk to us sometime in the future, because we're crazy about you here.
Yeah.
Well, love you guys. I'm very honored that you called me. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise.
You too, sir.
Thank you so much.
And listen, thank you for celebrating Buckaroo, too. I really appreciate you guys doing that.
David Hyde Pierce is a beloved actor, particularly for his unforgettable performance in the television classic Frasier. But his new role in the independent film The Perfect Host turns the image of Niles Crane completely on its head. This is one of the most buzzed-about films at this year's Sundance Film Festival, and it screens Sunday, January 24th, Wednesday, January 27th, Friday, January 29th, and Saturday, January 30th. In this interview, Mr. Pierce discusses the Sundance Fest, during which he's also performing hosting duties at the weekending awards ceremony, and his exciting new role in this twisted thriller. This is an interesting project for you, and I read a recent Vanity Fair interview, the headline of which was, David Hyde Pierce doesn't want you to know what his new movie is about. So that's always tricky. I mean, you want to get the word out about the film, and yet the film holds so many surprises, you want it to be new for people when they see it.
That's exactly where we find ourselves with this. Unfortunately, I mean, the producers took a sort of tricky strategy, which is they really didn't let out screeners of this. I think they started letting people see it today because we premiere tonight. And but it sort of paid off. I'm here at Sundance now, and there seems to be a pretty good buzz about the movie. But it's hard because it is the kind of movie that it's got a lot of twists and turns and surprise things happening, and you just don't want to give that stuff away because that's the fun of watching it.
Well, I would think that obviously you've done so much work on film, on TV, on the stage, and varied performances, but I would think the pervasive perception of you is probably more than likely Frasier. And that was a very specific kind of character, and this movie, it turns that on its head in a way. Was that a big drawing point for you to this project?
I wouldn't say it was the biggest drawing point, but it certainly factored into wanting to do it. Above all, it's a great character and a really cool script, and so that was the first thing that drew it to me. As I thought about it, I realized that I think one of the reasons I'm a good choice for the part is that it's good to have someone who's known in the way I'm known more for Frasier, mainly, as you said, that's the thing most people know me from, because you think, okay, I know who this is, I know kind of what this will be like. So then it's more of a surprise when it goes to sort of darker places. If it was Russell Crowe or Kevin Spacey, you wouldn't be surprised at all.
Tell me about the shooting of this, because I'm interested in, as an independent film, how does that translate into a different experience for you as an actor?
Yeah, there's very specific ways. It's much faster. There's much less downtime for the actor. It's all things that are good from my perspective. A lot of the aspects of filmmaking that didn't appeal to me was that sitting around forever while they relight and the endless month being away from home. This actually, the location that I mainly shot in was 2 blocks from my house in Los Angeles. Mm. And there was, and also a great thing that is not necessarily a hallmark of independent film, but Nick, our director, Nick Tomney, we got to rehearse for several days, me and Clayne Crawford, who plays the other leading role. And that was valuable time. As Nick will tell you, ironically, what made it valuable is it was easier for us to be spontaneous because we had done that work ahead of time. We sort of found the arc of the movie in rehearsal so that then really no matter where we were, we could sort of go with it and stay sort of attached to the arc of the film.
So give me a sense of when you get the script, the work you do on it on your own, and then how that matures and kind of blossoms when you're actually in the physical process of doing it.
Yeah, it's a lot of the work, the pre-production work, mainly was learning lines. I had been advised by friends who'd done a lot of independent film. They said, look, you can't do this like a regular movie where you sort of prepare each day ahead of time because they do too much. They shoot too much. You won't have time to learn stuff the night before. So that was part of it is just simply getting all the whole script in my head. There were specific character things that I had to work on I probably won't talk about right now because they're sort of part of the surprise of the movie. But
right.
And then what happens in the moment is really the stuff that gets brought out of you by the other actor. I was really lucky with this cast. Because that's true for film or stage or anything. Your best work comes when you're really connected to the other performers, and they're connected to you, and then you do stuff that you can't plan, and that's really wonderful.
Let me ask you about the festival itself. You say that there seems to be a buzz about the film. How does that manifest itself? How can you sense that?
People talking about it on the street. When someone says to you, oh, what's your movie? I'm in The Perfect Host. And they go, oh, yeah, I've heard about that. The other way there's buzz is not specifically the movie itself, but we're part of this the festival. It's called Park City at Midnight, and
mm-hmm.
it's a very unique branch of the festival, which is sort of wild, dark, creepy movies that crazy people go to watch at midnight. And So when people find out that you're part of that that part of the festival, even if they haven't heard specifically about the movie, they get excited because they think, oh, we kind of know that this will be a fun ride, whatever it is.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was going to ask about, because it premieres later tonight at midnight, 11:59 p.m., according to the schedule.
Yes. Right.
So that fits in with the personality of the film, that time for you.
Well, and also I don't know if you've spent a lot of time at Sundance, but we're premiering at the Egyptian Theater, which is a great old movie house. And there's something very gothic. Nick, our director, described it recently, the movie, as sort of a gothic David Hockney painting, because Hockney did all these really, brightly colored L.A.-type poolside paintings, but this has this kind of mossy overgrowth. And I think this theater is perfect for that, so...
Have you attended Sundance in the past?
I was here about 8 years ago for Wet Hot American Summer.
Yeah.
This is a great comedy that I got to be in. And I love it here. It's real, and I'm seeing other stuff. I saw The Company of Men last night, which is a John Wells film that's great. Looking forward to seeing other things. As my schedule loosens up later in the week, I'm here through the week because I'm hosting the awards at the end. So
right.
I get time in the middle to see as much as I can of the other stuff that's playing.
There's been a lot of press about their efforts to kind of revitalize, reinvigorate the festival. But what is the personality of Sundance for you? Because it seems like a very a very tight-knit, film-loving community. Do you still get that sense from that festival?
Totally. I mean, the people walking up and down the street, half of them actually have cameras in their hands because they're either, I don't know what they're doing, they're either finishing their movies before it screens or shooting documentaries or documenting their own being, the fact that they're being at Sundance. The excitement, I think what's cool about Sundance is it's now literally but also figuratively an institution, and that can breed bureaucracy. It can become part of the establishment that it sort of grew up in rebellion against, and that really hasn't happened here, and I feel that very strongly this year especially. I think because of the economics of the film world, a lot of the excess and extravagance that's grown up around the art of making film has been blown away, and what's left standing is the core of what Sundance was always about, which is people who have an independent view, people who have look at things differently, who show us things that maybe we've seen before but never thought about in this way. And I think, coincidentally, I think the country is kind of ripe for that. We're also disillusioned with most of our major institutions and sort of the banking system, the political system, and all of that. And the time is ripe for people who step outside the mainstream and look in and sort of hold the mirror up to us.
When you get scripts for independent projects, do they tend to excite you the most because they're more outside of the box somehow?
They can be. It is as possible to make a crappy independent film as it is to make a crappy big studio film. So
right.
I don't think, you know, that and the reverse is true, too. But certainly that's an appeal. And it's also an appeal, like doing a movie like this. It's an appeal for me because aside from getting away from the specific character that I played, say, on television for all those years, it also gets me away from that kind of mainstream image. And I have no complaints about that. I loved doing my show, and I think it was on at the time when television comedy was really quite respected and deserved to be. But it's nice for me to be able to step away from even step away from Broadway for a little while, step away from television for a little while, and be in this other atmosphere.
It seems like with this role, there's a sense of, and you're speaking to it, a sense of freedom. Did you feel that doing it?
Oh, totally, totally. And that's really, it's because the part allows you to do that. And also because Nick, I'm so amazed with him because he's basically a first-time director. He certainly is a feature of this size.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the pressures of low budget and crunch for time and everything else, he maintained not only a great atmosphere on the set, allowing us to feel safe, allowing me and Quain to feel like we could really go anywhere and go to places that these characters needed to go, but also with a sense of complete control that he really knew what he wanted. He was open to stuff, but he had such a, you know, he's lived with this movie for 10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
It's been developing since he did a short that this is based on 10 years ago. And so he knows the characters inside out, so he both gave us total freedom and real guidelines, and that's which is the ultimate freedom in this kind of schedule.
I would think that would be a tricky balance to reach, because as you say, he needs to establish himself as being in complete control of the environment, and yet allow you the freedom to imagine and explore. What kind of conversations would you have on the set, director and actor conversations?
I think that most of them were the conversations that people who, even though we really were meeting on this movie, the conversations that people who know each other very well have, which are very shorthand
mm-hmm.
types of things. I think... he just is instinctively a good director. I don't think I know he'll tell you he did a lot of reading of how you talk to actors and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think none of that ultimately mattered because he is able to be really in the moment and without being arrogant has a real confidence so that he didn't have to prove himself the leader. He didn't have to. He just sort of was. And he had, you know, in Klain and in me, he had two performers who have strong opinions and ideas about how things are done, and was able to accommodate us, accommodate our different working styles. We worked, Klain and I are very different kinds of actors, which played beautifully for the two parts that we were given. And that whole rehearsal period really allowed us to, the three of us, to merge into one cohesive working unit, so that by the time we hit the set, those conversations you referred to could be pretty brief. And you know, if he told me more, I'd done, that was cool. And if he said that's too much, I got it. It was not much more than that, and just proving true.
Well, too, he's the writer of it as well. So mm-hmm. as a writer director, you know that he knows the material better than anyone. I mean, he's the go-to guy without question.
I've also been in the experience where it can be a disadvantage to have the writer directing, because you like to have sometimes that extra set of eyeballs. There are cases where a writer just can't see beyond what they've written, and Nick was not that way. He really was able to make changes because of either circumstances on the shoot or things that came out in performance. He was just saying to me that in seeing this finished film, there are levels that even he didn't know were going to be part of the film. And that's what happens when you get a bunch of creative people sort of functioning with all pistons going and allowed to do their best work.
Yeah. I'm curious about you having done this for many, many years. Has the what you enjoy about it, has that changed your appreciation of it or your reasons for doing it over the years?
Yeah, I always, really until this film, when people ask me about, what do you prefer, theater, film, or TV, I'd always say theater first. And movies I always put last, because all that stuff I was saying before about sitting around and waiting, and also as an actor, losing control, having, no matter what you do, it ends up being in the hands of the director, in the hands of the editor. That bizarre concept that even though you have a scene with another human being, in fact, they're only shooting your side of the scene for 17 hours, and then 2 days later they're going to shoot that person's side of the scene, and then someone else is going to put them together. That, you know, just personally, as an actor, was always creepy to me. I liked being on stage. I liked having, or even in front of a live audience on TV, having the artistic control be right there in my hands and with me and the other actors. But this movie really, maybe it was the nature of the part, how much different kind of stuff I got to do in the part, the nature of the collaboration. I really got to see why actors I respect so much really enjoy making movies, because in the right circumstances it can be creative in a very different way, and you can, I think in any circumstance, whether you're on stage or in film or whatever, the most wonderful things are when you are surprised by yourself. It isn't something you planned. It isn't a choice you made. Something happens that's just right, and it's kind of beyond you. Those are great moments. And this is a movie where I was able to have that experience, which made it very exciting.
I can imagine that when you do stage, before you go on, no matter how many years you've done it, there's probably a level of nerves that overtake you. But when you're premiering a film, as you are tonight, how does that feel? How is that anticipation? Are you nervous at all, anxious?
When I'm doing theater now, I don't get nervous. I get excited. No, I don't. I love it, you know, and I just look forward to doing it and look forward to I had a great experience. I got to do a two-person play with Uta Hagen. Uta Hagen was one of the great American actresses and also one of the great American acting teachers.
Right.
And there was something about that experience of doing the play with her that kind of either officially confirmed or broke open something in me about a play being just, you walk in the door and then it just starts happening. So there's nothing to be nervous about, because you've done your work and you just go out and 2 hours later or whatever, it's done, and you've had this adventure with the other people on stage, and I love that. Having said that, I am so nervous about tonight because, again, I have no control. It's done, and even though I've seen a rough version of it, I'll tell you that I'm excited about tonight because I'm going to get to see it on a big screen. I'm going to get to see the finished print, the final mix. I'm going to get to hear the music, which Nick is very excited about. He found a wonderful composer for the movie, and I've heard none of that. So I'm excited about that part. The idea of sitting with people seeing it for the first time and all of us finding out together how much it works, that is very that's very nervous-making.
Yeah. Well, when you watch a film that you're in, can you ever lose yourself in the film? Can you separate your experience of making it from actually watching the finished project?
I think it takes a few, well, probably never totally, but I know even with being on Fraser or whatever, seeing myself seeing the thing for the first time, I usually need to see it a second time to actually take in the whole thing and be able to have a sense of how it is. So in that way, I kind of prepped for tonight because I have seen a rough cut, and I know generally that I'm extremely happy with what I saw. So I, in terms of my own feelings about it, I know I'm only going to be happier tonight because of all the extras that I haven't gotten to see that's going to, you know, make it really pop. But I just don't know, you know, when you're part of something like this, it's a whole different event. Last night being at the screening with John Wells, who's got a lot of experience under his belt, but he announced his film and said, you know, we don't know if this works. They've seen it. About 200 people, they said, have seen it. But until you put it in front of an audience of people, that's when you find out.
It really is like giving birth because the experience of putting it together, you are in a bubble in a kind of way, and the final birthing process is presenting it to an audience. Does it become alive in a kind of way when it's in front of an audience that makes it feel new, like a new film?
Yeah, it does, and that's really weird because I understand that totally on stage. We always say the audience is like the third leg of the stool when you're doing the play, that you do your last rehearsal, and when you put it into the first audience, first preview, things happen on stage that you didn't plan because some instinct in all the actors is reinforced by the audience, and there's a big aha moment that happens throughout the course of the evening, and sort of in the air in between the stage and the seats, something happens that makes the thing come together. And it happened. I don't know how it can happen in a movie because the movie's done. There's nobody up there paying attention to the audience. It's a finished thing, but it somehow reveals itself in a different way when you have those people, when you experience it with all these other people.
Now, what's next for you? Are you going to go back to the stage soon, or another project?
I'm hoping to. There's a play that I'm hoping to do in London, and we're waiting to see about some casting issues, but that would be my next project, which would be a theater thing, and then if that works out, then we might bring it to New York afterwards. If that doesn't work out, I don't know. I'm just going to maybe stay here and go skiing.
I'm sure you'll be fine. You'll find plenty of work out there. There's no problem. I wish you the best of luck with the screening tonight. I'm crazy about what
you do.
I thank you so much for giving your time today to me.
Sure. Pleasure talking to you.
That's it for this episode of The Best of Movie Geeks United. You can access our entire archive of over 700 filmmaker interviews by visiting moviegeeksunited.net.